everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you, with The Positive Mind. Special edition today, usually on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 1 p.m. Today we're bringing you something special. Today I bring you someone who has come to New York City, living in New York, Claire Quirons. It's not pronounced right, is it? It's close.
Yeah, it's very close.
From Amsterdam. You give us the pronunciation, Claire.
Yeah. It's Claire Quirons. And in Dutch, it's actually Claartje Quirons.
Okay. And what you're doing here is you're here to actually interview me for a project you're working on, which you're going to be bringing back to Amsterdam. Is that not right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's what we're going to do today. Let's talk about you and your project, and then I thought this would be a unique opportunity for people to hear you interview me.
Yeah, well, it's a great opportunity, so thank you so much. I came to New York City 4 years ago, and actually everybody I met was in therapy, and then I wanted to do something with this phenomenon. But it was very difficult, because what I actually wanted to do was people filming during their sessions. And so it took me a while to get the right people, and I actually found them now, but I'm still doing interviews with therapists. And so that was the reason I came to you, and I had this opportunity to interview you on radio. So that's great.
So let's do it.
Yeah. My first question actually is what you did before you became a therapist. What did you do?
Before I became, I started off with, I wanted to be a jazz musician when I was very young. And I wanted to be a jazz musician. I lived on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. I was with many jazz musicians who were very famous at the time, you know, and I was hanging around that neighborhood.
Like who?
Oh, everyone. Hank Jones, Thad Jones, Elvin Jones, the Paul Chambers, Lee Morgan, Booker Irvin. These were all the big names at the time, or these are very famous people. And it was really, the world was about jazz. But I saw that it was kind of a dead end. Number one, I don't think I was a good enough drummer to have really made it, as many others I had seen who were much better. But I also saw that there were certain problems I was running into being a jazz musician, and seeing around me, most jazz musicians were strung out, either with alcohol or with grass or with depression or with, you know, other drugs. So I said, well, this isn't going to work for me. I'm going to go get a job. I got a job working in Wall Street.
As
17
what?
Years old. I went to work as Wall Street. It was like a go-boy. I was going to get things for people. But I had a certain talent down there. And I soon became a star in Wall Street, working as a trader, actually making money. By the time I was 21 years old, I had made a substantial amount of money, and I went to school at night to study psychology. And it was through going to school at night, around age 21, 22, I was going to school at night to become a psychologist, to learn about psychology.
And why psychology?
Now,
why?
At age 22, I think it was, I went into therapy. I met a therapist. I went into therapy myself, and he greeted me warmly, and I remember the feeling of it, and I wanted to learn more about my mind. Now I was intrigued, because I was learning about myself. And at the time, he had this. He looked at me, and he said, oh, you would be a very good analyst. You know, he says, I would like to train you to become one.
And what were your issues back then?
I was angry. I was angry. I grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. There was, you know, there was a lot of anger left over from early childhood. So those issues had to be kind of cleaned out.
And angry towards what?
Everybody. Everybody, everything. Good old peaceful Armand DeMille, the positive mind, was just one angry young guy, as was everybody in my neighborhood. We grew up in the slums of New York, where it was mostly gang wars and fighting and stuff like that.
You were also a gang member?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. What did you do?
You mean as a gang member? What
yeah.
was my job? Fight. That's what we all did. We fought and we made plans to fight. That's all we did. Mostly we made plans to fight. We actually fought a lot less than we made plans to fight.
And to get what?
Well, I think we were imitating the war. This is at a time right post-Second World War, or it was during the Second World War. No, it was right after the Second World War, where soldiers were seen as warriors, and they were seen as great heroes. So in a way, we felt like soldiers, and we called ourselves soldiers, you know, and we were fighting for our turf, and we would be fighting other gangs who would try to get our neighborhoods. It was really silly stuff. But it was like a coming of age, and it was very, and so one gang would be challenging another gang, and we'd make up reasons to have fights, and most of us would try to run away from the fights and not show up in the first place, but there were a lot of them.
Yeah.
It was like the movie The West Side Story without the dancing.
Okay, I'm going to rent it. And then your time when you were trained, how was that? I mean, what?
Oh, that was wonderful. I was loving the respect for my intelligence. I should also say that when I was young, I had studied chess became a hobby. The game of chess, as you know from one of our mutual friends. And I became a chess master at a very early age. So at a very young age, at around 14, 15 years old, I learned that I could use my mind to fight battles, to win wars, but also to just compete. Now, chess played an important part. So we have chess and we have music, which means we have the mind and we have music both working together. So then I went into being a studying psychology, and I had somebody who also said, you know, we enjoy the way you think. Let us train you. And so I went into training. And this is at a time, even before I got my graduate degrees, at a time when it was not required to have these advanced degrees. So I was being trained while I was going to graduate school at night, while I was working in Wall Street, while I was also a jazz musician and, by the way, a photographer as well.
A lot of energy, though.
A lot of energy.
And what was the what kind of family did you come from? What kind of background do you have?
French and Italian, and parents were living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. I have also two sisters.
And were they poor? What were the
mostly
social circumstances?
Poor, trying not to be poor.
Yeah, and was that also your motivation to get out of it, or?
Good question. Poverty doesn't bother me. Not poverty as much. Not having things, you'd always find a way around having things. It wasn't the poverty. It was the quality of life surrounding the poverty. It was the way that people were with each other when they didn't have. If they didn't have enough something, they would be angry with each other. There would be a negativity all the time. It's not the poverty that's the issue.
Anger.
It's the mental set that goes with the poverty.
Yeah.
So it was mine was to get out. And I guess you're right, because there's another point. I remember one time I rented an apartment, and I was with one of my first apartments, and it was in a high rise. And I remember saying to myself, I want to take this apartment because it's so high up, because rats can't climb this high. So there was this kind of poverty mentality of growing up in a place, growing up in a neighborhood where there were rats everywhere. You know, that we were threatened by them all the time. So here it was carrying with me. But then when I went to Wall Street, I made a lot of money. I was somebody who had the touch of gold.
And so you were also the star of your family, or not? Did you support them?
Yeah, sure I did. But a star of the family, they were all stars. My two sisters are both stars. There was like, yes, I was a male child, and of course I was a star, and I was the one getting the most recognition. But they were stars in their own way.
And your sisters, what do they do now?
One was a public school teacher. But she's fabulous. I mean, she was just a great teacher. She had a lot of recognition. And the younger one, my younger sister, is a psychologist also.
That's funny. Two psychologists in one family.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
We needed a lot of mental health. When I was interested, of course, I had this younger sister who kind of followed me where I went. And so when I got involved in psychology, she got involved in psychology, and I brought her along with me. Not brought her along, she followed along, and then she took her own turn.
And can you tell me your first experience with therapy? How was it? Did you have to lay on the couch, or how was it these days?
Back in those days, you mean? It was a kind of a remarkable event, because I remember walking into a room where this man was going to, I was going to see this man, not because I thought I had any problems, but the woman I was dating at the time said she wanted me to meet her therapist. I walked in his room, and he shook my hand so warmly and looked at me in such a warm, non-threatening way that I melted. And I remember that was my first moment. I think about that a lot when I see the clinic that I run, and I watch how people greet people. And I look and I wonder if anybody's ever getting that magical feeling, you know, when you first meet, when you meet somebody for the first time, when you meet a therapist for the first time, you should feel this gush of warmth come over you, which means you feel safe. I felt safe back then. And I felt that first time, it's the first time I was with an adult male where I said to myself, this is really okay.
Yeah. So, and how did he inspire you to become a therapist?
After, I think, about a year of therapy, he kept reinforcing, he kept validating my thinking over and over again. He said, it's a very interesting way you see that. Your mind is very interesting, he said. And so over and over again, he would keep seeing me come up with ideas about myself and challenges about myself, and he thought that it would be a good field for me.
Yeah. And what actually, so then you became a therapist, and what is actually so beautiful about being a therapist?
It's a wonderful profession. Therapist may not be the right word, but we use therapist as a word. I don't like to do therapy myself anymore. But being able to understand people at a level where you can understand them in a way that they've never been understood before, where you can get people. When I say get, I mean they feel understood. I think of myself as a psychodetective. You know, my job is to kind of find out who is this person? What's this person like? What do they feel? What's their life like? What are their moment-to-moment life like? What is their background like? What did they go through? What adaptations did they have to make to get through life? What were their strategies? And then seeing their strategies and seeing these are just they're doing the best they can to get through. I want to know where they could go from here. Can they get, how do we kind of get these strategies to relent? So if a person is paranoid, for example, and that their paranoia protected them from ever being vulnerable again, how do I get that paranoia to relent long enough so that I could really talk to this person, you know, and get to this person in some kind of way? And what method will I use? And when will I be loving too much, or when will I be loving too little? And when is my warmth welcome and when is it not welcome? And it's really quite a mystery. And it's exciting. It's much like all the other things I've ever done. It's much like music. It's like playing music. It's much like being in the music. It's like being in the band.
Okay, can you explain that, the music and the mind?
When you're a drummer, you want to catch the right rhythm. You want to be able to lay down a rhythm so that everybody can develop their own music around you. If you don't tune into the rhythm, if you're not there, if you don't lay down the right rhythm, everybody kind of gets off. You know, they go off in tangents. When you're a therapist, you want to lay down the rhythm. I want to lay down the rhythm so that that person can actually effect and evolve their own music, that they could bring it out of themselves. But I want to provide the rhythm of it.
And how do you do that? Can you describe that to me? Maybe with a case or?
Sure. A few things I do. One thing I do is I catch the rhythm of their breathing. I catch the rhythm of their thinking. I catch the modulations in a person's voice. I try to enter where they are, not where I am. So if a person, let's say a person comes in and they're very nervous and they're talking very fast. And they're talking, and I don't know what to do. My world is just, you know, it's really terrible. I had a terrible thing. My husband, my wife, my children, my everything is just terrible. If I talk to them, I'm not going to do what most therapists would do, would be calm down, you know, which is what they say. No, I'll go in with them. I'll say, yes, I can understand your problem. I can understand how this is going on, and I'll match them right at their speed. And then I'll slowly bring my voice slower and slower and slower and deeper. And I'll start breathing in between while I'm talking. And this will model them. And you'll see they pick up and they follow you right along till they could talk to you without, with a lot less anxiety. That's just an example of one of the techniques that I would use. Or sometimes a person is trying to prove that they're not crazy. So I want to know, I know this. I know they're saying to me, tell me I'm not crazy. Tell me I'm not crazy. So I tell them they're not crazy. I'll actually find the need, try to fit the immediate need, try to get rid of the fear so that we could get down to what we need to talk about. It's a great science. It's not really a science. It's a great art. Great.
And for how long have you been a therapist in New York City?
Well, now 35 years.
Wow, that's a long period. It's even older than I am. No, it's exactly as old as I am.
I know. It started when you were born.
Yeah.
Because when you were born, they said, we're going to need a lot of shrinks around here. No. I actually started when I was in training, and I was about 26 years old. They started us doing therapy, even though we were under supervision. Then I was still working in Wall Street, and I was in training. And I was working in Wall Street, and I was just going to work till I was 30 years old. I remember saying to myself, I'm going to quit when I'm 30, and I'm going to go into doing this, psychotherapy, full-time, because I loved it. And even though Wall Street represented a lot of money, the money had no meaning. It was like playing Monopoly. It was a game. It was like shooting chickens. It was, you know, the game. It's like you're doing this thing over and over again, but it's not, it doesn't have any meaning.
And you never went back to Wall Street. It was never very seductive, the money.
Of course the money is seductive. In fact, it's the funniest thing. WBAI, the radio program we're broadcasting on, moved from 33rd Street, of all things, and 8th Avenue, which is right near my office, and they took an office on Wall Street. They built their studio on Wall Street. So I actually went back to Wall Street in a whole different way. Yes, the money's seductive. Yes, I understand finance. Yes, I do see that. But I'm the kind of person who I kind of always create whatever I need. So if I need money, money kind of appears.
I see. And, well, now a little bit more about my documentary. So I came here four years ago, and everybody I met was in therapy. And why do you think everybody have their own therapist in New York City?
I've heard you say that, Claire. And you're just hanging out in the right neighborhoods. Because, you know, I'll take you to certain places in the Bronx where not everybody's in therapy.
No, I mean Manhattan.
You mean Manhattan specifically?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's look at that idea. The idea of Manhattan is two things. I'm going to give you two answers. One is kind of a simple sociological one. In order to live in Manhattan, you've got to have more money than the average folk. And most of the people around your age who have enough money to live in Manhattan have excess money, right? And they're going to take that excess money and perhaps spend it on therapy. It's one of the things. But there's something bigger to it. John Gray, who was a recent guest on our show, talked about the need for people to increase their serotonin levels inside their brains because the serotonin gets depleted by the energetic system of something like Manhattan. In other words, the frenzy of the city creates a hormonal imbalance. One of the things that wind up creating that increase in serotonin and bringing that back is a conversation, a simple one-to-one conversation. If you sit and relax with somebody and you talk to them and it's on a one-to-one level with no distractions at all, you actually feel a sense of calm come over you. I'm sure you know what that's about.
Yeah.
But you don't get much of a chance to do that in New York. People are very busy. Your friends won't sit down with you and just talk to you for that length of time. So there's one thing. Having somebody sit down with you and not judge you and just help you relax makes you feel better. It's like a warm bath. It's like a great thing. It's like a wonderful form of relaxation. That's item number one. Item number two, most people living in Manhattan are single and they don't have their families around. So they're missing that essential connection. So you give them another connection. You recreate family in a way with a therapist. Most friends are competitive. You create a friend in a therapist. Also, people like to learn about themselves. We also probably have more gymnasiums, more workout places in Manhattan than anywhere else. So if you work for your body, if you work out your body, if you work on your muscles, why don't you work on your mind? Right? It's like if you're going to shape up the rest of you, why don't you shape up your mind? Now, if you live out on a farm, there's enough work for you to do that your body stays in shape. Normally, if you have enough of an outdoors, like if you live in Los Angeles or in Florida, people go to far less therapy in Hawaii because they have nature. Has got its healing. In New York, in Manhattan, there's something about it that seems to require that you make that kind of essential contact with somebody. And I think a lot of it has to do with you don't have a great available outdoor that's always healing you. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting. Also, I was very interested in your answer about the fact that New York creates a disbalance. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. Somebody comes to New York for the first time. I look at them and I always say to them, I always think to myself, they're here for the first time. It's going to take them 2 years to find out whether they could be here or not. Why? There's a pulse to Manhattan. There's a rhythm. There's a speed to Manhattan. And it's like a heartbeat that's pumping fast. It is that kind of rhythm. If you're somebody who can't handle that, you become out of rhythm. If you become out of rhythm, you just can't stand it. Your body will get sick. What everybody who comes to New York tries to do or will eventually do is they will either adjust to the New York rhythm or they'll run away. Because it's such a speed. Everything moves. It moves different than it does in Paris, which also moves fast, but it has that slowness to it, and it has the country, and it has the bigness to Paris, you know? This is like more like Tokyo. This is like fast-moving, high-paced, fast. And if you can get into it, if you get into the rhythm of it, you'll survive. But if you fight it, if you resist it, it'll weigh you down.
And does it also tell us something about the future? Because I think, in a way, New York is, you know, the city. It's a very modern city. It's there is maybe not much of community life, a lot of singles, as you said. And do you think it will be for all the cities, maybe in Europe, or all the big modern cities, the future will be like life is now in New York?
Hmm. Is New York the aberration? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think New York is one of those towns that have gone a little too high speed.
And how come?
I don't think it functions too well. There's a little irritability in it. There's a little nastiness to it. There's a little, there's a high crime rate. It's showing all of that. There's this imbalance. And the thing that's beginning to happen in New York is this poverty level, this poverty imbalance now. It used to be that New York housed the poor people and the rich people in Manhattan. That's kind of disappearing. Now everybody in Manhattan has to have above average income. There is no more, the poor people are being moved into the suburbs and the boroughs, you know, they're being moved into the Bronx and Queens. So where it used to be a battle between them who have and them who don't have, and a lot of violence in the streets and a lot of fear, there's not so much. The city, I believe, is calming down. I don't believe the city is winding up. You've been here for how many years now? 2 years?
4 years.
4 years. Have you seen the city get calmer?
No.
No. I guess maybe I just gotten calmer. It just seems it to me. It seems like it's kind of winding down.
Well, maybe since September 11th. I mean, that's another thing. I think the city really has changed in that sense. I mean, I don't know how to describe it, but I think there is a constant feeling of lost. It's maybe too much, but there is a sadness, I would say. Anxiety more than it was before September 11th. Don't you think?
Well, okay, it's a good question. I think there was a frenzy before September 11th. And a frenzy is always a hidden despair somewhere underneath it. I think when you believe you're invulnerable and then something kind of pierces through and breaks through and it makes you cry, you can't fight it anymore. And I think you're right. There's kind of a general sadness. Wounded. It's a wounded city. And we're living in a wounded city. And I think that touches everybody. No matter how we ignore it, no matter how we make believe it's not happening, it's a wounded city. We've been hurt. Even though the bones have healed, we've been hurt. We didn't think we could get hurt. And I think there's a lot of people who feel that and walk around differently than they did in the past. Very differently.
Yeah, I totally agree. Can I another question?
Sure.
Yeah? And do you see a pattern in problems in New York City, like loneliness, alienation, disorientation, disconnection?
There's a number of them. The primary complaints, I could say, that people come in with. The primary complaint that people come in with is a relationship that's failed. And why that becomes the main issue is because when you're in a relationship, you kind of put all your hopes that you're going to get happy. And so you bury yourself a lot, and you bury a lot of your grief behind the hope of this relationship. When that relationship fails, for many people, they come crashing down to a basic place inside themselves where they say, I'm not happy now and I've never been happy. So the primary reason that I think people seek therapy is because of a failed relationship. But underneath that is a despair that needs help. That's, I say, is number one. Number two, some people feel numb. And somehow they wake up, but a lot of people have kind of adjusted to life by going numb. They don't feel anything anymore. And they want to feel something. And they get tired of it. And they hear of a therapist who helps bring you back to your feelings. And so they go for that. And they're really saying, help me feel again.
And why numb?
Numb is one of these strategies that we use to not feel pain. You know, we just make ourselves go numb. We make ourselves go blank. It's like the teller's window in a bank. You know, it's 3 o'clock. No more deposits. You close that window and nobody could get to you anymore. Hey, we've got to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this interview. Here's some music from Don Byron. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI in New York City. Thank you.
walks who it is. Like right now, there's less people coming in, they're more spread out. If people see somebody give, they'll tend to give more than if, like, a lot of people are walking by and nobody sees anybody give, they're not going to give. Yeah. Monkey see, monkey do.
Don Byron. Don Byron, this is Armand DeMille with you, with the positive mind, being interviewed. Actually, you know, I'm probably, when you're hearing this, I'm out of town. And I saved this for a day when I was out of town, and I would play something special for you. Claire. I'm not even going to pronounce your name. I want to learn how to do it. Quirijns?
Quirijns. That's Dutch. So in English, I always tell people that my name is Quirijns.
Quirijns.
That's right.
Quirijns. Quirijns?
Yeah.
I got it. What's so hard about that?
Yeah, no. Perfect.
Perfect. And then you have your friend Martijn.
Yeah.
Right? It was in someone I know. It's with a J-N.
Yeah, it's the same. It's also Martijn is also I-J-N.
I-J-N, yeah.
Yeah, but you don't know this.
They have these funny J's in your name. It's because you smoke so much dope there. They didn't have a J originally. What do we do? Let's just put a J in the middle of our name here. Mm. Yeah, I kind of enjoy it.
Yeah.
Thank you. So let's continue this. This is fun.
Yeah.
So you wanted to know something else.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to know, while we were talking about the problems, maybe typical problems in New York City, it was actually very clear. You made it very clear why New York is totally different than other places. But we were talking about loneliness, alienation, disorientation, and disconnection between people. What kind of pattern do you see with your patients?
Not only with my patients, but where I live and the apartment I live in and my neighborhood, I'm seeing more alienation. Again, I don't want this to be a program about 9/11, but since 9/11, I see more people being self-protective, supportive of the people around them, but now we have these little islands creeping up. And by little island, I mean you live in your apartment, I live in my apartment, I don't bother you, you don't bother me. It's not, the neighborhood is kind of disappearing. This feeling of a supportive neighborhood. One of the nice things about growing up in a suburb or in a town or in Amsterdam is like you walk down the street and you know everybody and everybody's friendly. And you don't have to watch over your shoulder thinking somebody's going to grab your purse and hit you on the head. You know, because you could leave your door open in certain places, you know. And that feeling is kind of gone. So there's a basic lack of safety that people walk around with. A basic sense of, if I have to respond, I'm going to have to respond. If I have to duck, I'm going to duck. If I have to run, I'm going to run. So then they go to a therapist's office. In that therapist office, they don't have to run. They don't have to duck. They don't have to hide. They could relax. They go to group therapy. Group therapy is very interesting because in the group therapy, you're now with a bunch of people who have all agreed to lay down their arms. You know, we're going to be here in support of each other. That's really terrific. This is why I think AA became so popular, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. They offered people a family of people of like mind here in the city to be able to gather with other people. And that gives you a certain safety to maybe fight your battles a little better. We have Overeaters Anonymous. We have Smokers Anonymous. You know about these, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's actually very interesting to me as well, because I think also what I also see, but I'm an observer, what I also see is in a way a world divided in two worlds, the world where you can be yourself and the world that is safe, namely in the therapy room, And then the world outside, which is, you know, you can't really tell the truth because you have to be very successful and you have to be, you know, rich and you have to be, and of course nobody is rich and successful. So I also see two different worlds. Do you see that as well? The there where you can really tell the truth And then the society, the outside world, where you have to behave like you're somebody else.
Let's take that from two places, okay, Claire? One is, I want to tell a story about one time I was in the Caribbean somewhere, and I was swimming in a pool, and I was floating, and I like to float on the water. And I was floating, and suddenly some guys who were training in wearing undersea diving jumped in the pool wearing the full garb, and they were teaching them how to swim underwater. And it disturbed. It put ripples in the water, so I had to get up. So I got back to floating, and then they jumped back in the pool. And I said to myself, I remember laying in the sun saying, all I want to do is be here and lay in the sun and don't want to be disturbed, and I can't feel safe. I can't feel safe because these guys are jumping in and out of the pool. Well, they weren't bothering me in any way, but I couldn't feel safe because there was an activity going on. And then it suddenly hit me. I'm no more safe whether they're jumping in the pool or not. That safety doesn't have to do what's going on the outside. Safety has to do what's going on inside me. If I could find the spot of safety inside me, then I have a level of calm. I could respond to the outside if there's a danger, but I'm looking for the safe spot inside of me. So what's the goal in life? My goal, and I think the goal of most people I know, is to become an honest person. And an honest person is a person who is themselves no matter what. You're you. You're you if you're in business. You're you if you see a doorman. You're you if you see the grocery store man. Nobody would be surprised. Nobody who met me here would say to anybody else who met me socially, oh, he's not like that at all. My goal is to be the same wherever I am, is to be real. And that's what I hope for the people I work with, too. So that's what I think the goal is. So I think there are not this giant division.
So
of course, I'm sorry, just one more thing. If you're a little crazy, if you're somebody who's very hostile, if you're somebody who's very angry at everybody around you, you can't afford to be you all the time because you'll get fired. You got to straighten out your mind first. And then be you everywhere you go. Sorry.
No. I wanted to say, so that's a little bit your work, is to create the, irreal world in a realistic world. Is that true?
An unreal world?
Yeah, an unreal, that's the word. I'm so sorry, mm-hmm. I couldn't find it. You're creating actually a real world for the unreal world.
Yes, absolutely. That's beautifully said. It's like the Matrix. You know what I mean? It's like I know that what goes on out there. I know I'm passing 10,000 pieces of advertisement telling me that unless I buy this product, I'm going to die by tomorrow morning. Do you know what I mean? Or I have hemorrhoids, one or the other. You get some kind of problem if you don't buy the product. That's an unreal world out there. Advertising is unreal. The world is unreal. What people tell you is dangerous is unreal. But the self could be real. And the self could laugh at it. It's a dance. You look all around you and say, look at this. Here's a little bait. Here's a little red thing that they put here hoping it's going to attract me. It's okay. And you don't get angry at the world either. You're not being angry. You're not being judgmental. You're saying, that's the world, and I'm going to be me.
And that's your goal.
Yeah, it's my goal. I figure it'd take me another 30 years to get there, personally.
Yeah, and why do you think you're so popular? I mean, you have a lot of patients, and you don't even do therapy, but you're like a psycho detective, you told me.
I used to do therapy, and I just...
I know.
I don't have a chance to do it anymore. I mean, really, I'm seeing people now for one-time consultations, and I see them once, help them figure out what they've got, and then I'll tell them where to go to get their best results. If not, I'd just be seeing the same people all the time. So that's one item, okay? Also, I travel, and I have a schedule that doesn't allow me to be there with the consistency that's necessary for therapy. What was the question?
What do you think makes you so special?
Charisma. Charisma. But, you know, charisma is never in a vacuum. Charisma is as charisma does. That should be a license plate. You know, that should be one of those bumper stickers on a license plate. Charisma is an energy that fits a need, and the need is usually depression. I am a positive mind. I will put a positive spin on things. I will help people find the beauty in their lives, and I'll help them find it, no matter how miserable they are, no matter how bad they feel about themselves. I'm a good guy. I'm not one of these psychologists who get on the air and beat you up. And we have them. We have Joy Brown. We have a number of psychologists who do radio shows. They get on and they will tell you, you just got to do this and just got to do that and just got to do that. My belief is that people are doing almost as good as they can. Maybe they could do a little better. But I love them the way they are. And nobody has ever heard anybody love people this way. And by love, I don't mean, you know, kiss them and hug them and do all that stuff. I mean accept people the way they are and see their beauty. I do that, and I don't do that as an act. I mean, this is not something, I mean, I look at people and this is what I see. People come to see me and I look at them, and no matter how bent out of shape they are, no matter how paranoid, no matter how aggressive, no matter, you know, I'm hugging them. In effect, I saw an 18-year-old boy or a 17-year-old boy earlier today who broke his father's ribs by beating up his father. He beat up his father, and he broke his father's ribs, and he punched him around, and he wound up getting arrested, and he was in jail, and he was terrible. And he came in just before you, a few minutes before you. He sat in my chair. He didn't want to be around me on any level. I understood what it was like for this kid to have a mother who's always sick, to be told that he's totally responsible, and for him to go through life this way, and to feel the regrets that he felt about hurting his father. I mean, by the end of the session, the guy was looking at me like, man, you're cool. That's it. I'm cool. Why? Because I didn't judge him, because I didn't beat him up, because I didn't tell him to do something, because I didn't say he was wrong.
And what did you tell him?
I told him I don't think he's crazy. I told him I think that he's very frustrated, and he has every right to be. And I told him that I thought he lives all the way up in Connecticut somewhere. I said, if you had somebody to talk to, not to therapize you, not to shrink your brain, but if you had somebody to talk to, it would take the pressure off your mind. You wouldn't be exploding like that. And so it's a good thing. I said, but I don't want you to do anything just because I'm telling you to, and I don't think you need to know to think you're crazy. And he became very receptive. He was asking me for phone numbers by the end of the session. Another time I did a session with a teenage boy, we did it in here in the studio. He wouldn't talk. He refused to talk. He wouldn't talk to anybody, so I put him on the microphone, turned on some music, and we did therapy like this. You know, there's so many different ways to get to a person. There are so many different paths that I use whatever I can. I think that's what makes me so popular. Got a lot of tools, a lot of techniques, and basically I feel like I'm playing music.
Yeah, and a lot of experience as
and
well.
And a lot of experience and a lot of schooling.
Yeah.
A lot of education, see? A lot of degrees, a lot of streetwise wisdom, which is important, and a lot of experience.
Yeah.
So it works together.
Yeah. Another question. Do you believe in happiness, or is that an elusive dream?
Well, let me ask you. You mean the feeling of happiness or the state of mind?
State of mind.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I believe that there's a basic smile. Now, if happiness is giddy, if happiness is jump for joy, I think that's probably an aberration. But I think happiness as a basic smile is very possible. And in fact, it's life's only goal. It's where we got to go. Of course, if you live in a country like Afghanistan or in Iraq or in some place where you're getting bombed and you're just trying to survive, maybe the real goal is just survival, just keeping your head above water. But I think in an affluent society, the goal is a smile. You should be able to walk around and feel, there should be something, should be is a hard word, but I would like there to be something inside me, inside you, inside everybody I ever touch that knows the impact that they could have on every other human by just being decent. I think that's happiness.
Being decent.
Being decent, yeah.
And What is the ideal patient?
We have a nice phrase. It's called the Yavis syndrome, Y-A-V-I-S. And that was, I don't know if they use it. They use it in the 60s. It's called young, attractive, verbal, intelligent, and successful. Young, attractive, verbal, intelligent, and successful. These are the ideal patients for every therapist in New York. They want somebody who could pay enough money, who's not going to question them, who's intelligent, who is, you know, who's okay. That's the ideal person for somebody who wants to be in business. But what's the real ideal patient? Somebody you could get to. Somebody who matches your skill. Right? Who's the ideal saxophone player to the drummer? Right? One who catches his rhythm. And the ideal drummer is one who catches the tone of the saxophonist. So does that mean that every drummer is good for every situation? No. No. So I think it's the same with therapists. I think therapists are going to be great for some people, and other therapists are going to be great for other people. So I don't think there's an ideal patient. Certainly there's not an ideal therapist. So one of the things I do, Claire, you know, one of the things I developed was a method of matching the therapist to the client who comes in.
And how did you do that?
Well, a lot of things. There are a lot of things that are very important. One is we ask questions. Like, for example, if you ask a person a simple question like, were you closer to your mother or your father when you were a child, right? That's question number one. A person will say, is either closer to my mother or closer to my father. Then you ask them another question. Do you feel more comfortable with men or with women? So now, whenever you get two of the same sex, I was closer to my mother and I feel more comfortable with women. One of the things we know is the therapist should be a woman, not a man. And this is kind of silly, but it's so simple. If a person says, I was more comfortable with my father and I'm more comfortable with men than I am with women, the therapist should be a man. Because this is going to be the person they talk to more comfortably. We also ask them about their ordinal position, which is the position of their birth order. You know, they have younger brothers, younger sisters, older brothers, older sisters. And I match that all up with a therapist I know. Even use a thing called the Enneagram to kind of test out to see what personality type we're dealing with and kind of match that with the personality type of the therapist. Ideally, it is never therapy itself that doesn't work. It's the matching of the two. If the person meets the right therapist, they work together and they're just fabulous. It's music.
Yeah.
But usually it's a mismatch. You know, usually it's not a match. Usually it's just luck if they happen to match, you know.
I have a friend, and she had 17 therapists before finding the right one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, and another question. How easy is it to become I cannot pronounce the word suddenly.
That's okay.
Alienated from a certain day-to-day reality when this search for the perfect life, as it's being dictated by society, becomes overly important.
I almost got what you said. Try it again.
Well, I have
tell
the
me
feeling,
what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I have the feeling that you really have to be successful, that you have to be married or engaged or, you know, a nice job, intelligent. And if you're not, but you have to pretend you are, you become very alienated.
That's
from
a good point.
The reality. So you live in a certain, I think, you know, unreal world.
Sure. Let's say you wanted to get a role as an actor.
Yeah.
And you want to get a role as an actor and you go for an interview. And they say smile, but you're depressed. So now you go for the role as an actor. If you're not smiling, right, you're not going to get the job. So you have to be alienated from yourself. I think there's a certain amount of alienation we could afford. There's a certain amount of alienation we can't afford. If you're working in a job over and over again where you're working against your own ethic, your own moral, you're doing something you hate and don't believe in, I think it takes its toll on you. So I think there's a decision to be made. And the decision means if you got to go work on a farm and do something more harmonious with who you are, that's one thing. People don't know the toll. that it takes. I think if you're alienated from yourself, if you're doing something against what you believe in, against it, the opposite of, if you're a salesman on the phone who's doing cold calls, who's calling people up and telling them to buy your red paint because it's good for them, and you don't believe in it, and you're doing that, I think it works on you.
But I have the feeling that in New York City, I see it very often because the standard is so high here.
Mm.
The competition is so high.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you see the same? Do you observe what I see?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. To me, it's cute. See, to me, they're all children. All playing a silly game of, not silly, they're all playing a game that they think is necessary. The truth of it is, the person who is more comfortable with themselves, who is more in touch with their own heart, with their own soul, who walks around with a sense of wisdom and solidness, wins. The person who has got not the most aggressive shark, they win temporarily, but the person who's really solid, the mensch, the one who walks around and says, I'm here, you know, I'm here, I'm bright, I'm right present, I'm not afraid, and my heart's present. I think that person becomes a star. You could pick them out in the crowd. You could see somebody who feels comfortable with themselves. And they're the ones who get the jobs. They'll get the jobs, they'll make the living, they'll become the stars.
And when did you become solid?
Ugh, I never. I've got 30 more years to go. I'm on my way.
Where are you?
I'm a lot better than I used to be. And I'm just shy of where I want to be.
And but where do you want to be?
A little more just present all the time and not so... And not so involved in the pettinesses of life as I sometimes can get.
Like what? Can you give
like,
me
you know, like the small things like how do you take care of all the people around you and how do you, you know, deal with the responsibilities and how do you pay the rent and how do you do all of these things? Those are the things that I'd like eventually to be completely free of. Eventually. They're petty things, they're small things. And I get involved in a lot of them and sometimes I get upset if the ceiling falls down. And I'd like to be like Eli Zabar. Now, who is that? You know, this is going to be, we're going to make him famous. He's got a place up on Madison Avenue, and it's called the Eat, E-A-T. And I went in there one day, and I remember I was getting a cup of tea, and he was making sandwiches. And he was making all these sandwiches. He had like these 30 sandwiches all filled with food stuff. And I handed him my tea, and he was going to pack up my tea. And he spilled it all over these 30 sandwiches he must have been spending an hour to make without thinking about it, Claire. Without even a pause. He smiled at me. He wiped everything in the garbage. He said to his assistant, give me 30 more loaves of bread. He looked at me and said, would you mind getting another cup of tea for yourself? And I did it, and he packed it all up, and he didn't even miss a beat. I want to be like Eli Zabar.
Yeah, well, that's a beautiful story. And what about you being, you're seeing things that I can't see? What's that about you?
I think you said it before. There is a possibility that I may be some kind of a mystic and I may have some kind of unusual powers, but we know this. I have a great education. I have a lot of experience. I have street smarts. I'm observant. So I see things that other people don't see. They appear in front of me, and I think they would appear to most people if they had the same background that I do. And maybe there's a little touch of the unusual somewhere around me. You know, maybe so.
What do you see now?
I see you have a child, don't you?
Yeah.
You have a son?
No. Daughter.
Yeah. How are you doing with her?
Fine.
Yeah.
What do you see?
I see the nurturing part of you. Now, that's another story. We're going to have to go in on that. But, you know, I see that you're a person with a genuinely good heart who is trying your best to get through this world And you're talked about all the problems that you see, you know, the competition, having to put on a face, which I see you as somebody with a wonderful heart. And I'm really glad you're in New York doing this project. What's your daughter's name?
Roxy.
Roxy? Yeah. How old is she?
2 and 5 months.
Hmm. That's not easy, huh?
No, it's not. Sometimes it's especially difficult if you work and being a mother. I mean, it's a cliche, but sometimes it's really hard. But it's also nice. I couldn't, you know, live without her, and I couldn't live without my work. So I have to cope with it, I would say.
Well, I want to give you some names of some resources of people who are in similar situations. You know, with children of that age, it's really a kind of a marvelous thing that you're doing. I enjoyed this very much. We may have to do this another time. We've just about run out of time. This has been a pleasure. It's really wonderful
for me
to hear your questions, and it's quite a challenge. Claire, I appreciate it. This is Armand DeMille. If you wanted to receive a copy of this, you would call 1-800-575-0580. That's conference copy. Claire, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure. If you wanted to send me an email, it's armand@brainlink.com. I will be back with you shortly, my friends.